The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Currie Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
Welcome to another installment of Our Veteran Community, and you're listening either on KCIW Radio or podcast. And today I have a friend. I consider him a friend. I don't think he's a mortal enemy by any means. Dan Sherman, and I know Dan from the Vietnam Veterans of America local chapter here, and a number of other things. He's a fellow musician, you know, even though he plays mostly for his own enjoyment, but that's okay. So
less Dan, criticism that way.
Well, this is true. This is true. So, Dan, welcome to the studio.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being part of this. I think it's going to be groundbreaking broadcasting for the area here. So my hope is that people get to know our veterans better and that the veterans can speak openly about the things that do and don't work in the community. You know, so possibly we can get some of our legislators involved with, you know, doing some changes. So, yeah, it's a little bit of activism and a little bit of man on the street kind of stuff.
You didn't tell me about the activism part, so I'll just have to start a list here. Let's see. Number one.
I'm the one with the list, so you got to follow me.
All right.
At any rate, so how the show starts is finding out your story of origin. Where was you born?
East Orange, New Jersey, and I was only born there.
Okay, so...
My father was in the Army at the time.
Okay.
And he had trained to be a pilot. And just before he got shipped out to go probably to Europe to fight in the theater there, the war ended. And so he got shipped to East Orange, New Jersey, to a hospital there that was taking veterans from World War II, and he was assigned to be an orderly, even though he was a pilot. They had no need for pilots all
of
a sudden.
So he flew gurneys instead of planes.
So, well, he didn't fly them. He flew, as he says, he flew bedpans.
Okay.
And I was born there, and then, but I mostly hail from Oklahoma, I suppose. I grew up in Florida, Michigan, and Oklahoma. My grandparents were either in Florida. My mother's grandparents were in Florida. My father's grandparents were in Michigan, and my father wound up in Oklahoma, and so I kind of was raised there, even though I spent a little time with grandparents, etc. So ask me about Michigan snow.
Okay, so what about Michigan snow?
It's neat. It's really neat. You can go sledding in it, and... you can make snowmen, and you can do all of this cool stuff you can't do with Oklahoma because the snow's no good. I mean, the snow is either so wet, it's almost rain and ice, or but the snow in Michigan, and it snows, you know, on top of snow, on top of snow, and at least that's how I remember it as a 10-year-old kid.
Did you have to do much shoveling?
I don't think I did. I probably did, and knowing my grandfather, he always suckered me into doing little... things like that, so I probably did, but I don't remember it.
Okay, so no traumatic experiences over the snow shovel and all that kind of stuff.
No.
Good deal. How about school? Any memories from your educational, at least up until college days, stick out for you?
Probably the I swore I would never tell anybody this, and here this is to...
Oh, statute of limitations.
Thousands of listeners. Yeah, I remember writing a love note when I was, I think it was in the seventh grade. And for some reason, I just suddenly became really infatuated with this this girl in school. And I wrote this love note to her that I did not intend to give it to her, but some boy snatched it out of my back pocket and he read it to the entire class. Oh. And I felt absolutely humiliated. And yeah, that memory sticks out. Other than that, I don't know. I mean, you know, no, not really. That was probably it.
Yeah, that's probably it. So pretty normal, didn't have to deal with much bullying or any of that kind of stuff. Of course, we dealt with it differently back then.
I did. There were bullies. I mean, I've always been basically an artist. And another memory that does stick out, although I just kind of blow it off at this point. Actually, I blow the other one off, too, because I realize now, I mean, you know, teenage boys, they have these palpitations of the heart and stuff. But... this was, I was on the playground once, and I wasn't particularly into playing football. I was on the smaller side. So I would draw pictures generally during recess. I would take my notebook out, and I remember one guy came along, and there were a group of people who were watching me draw, mm-hmm. group of other kids. And for some reason, people do that. I do that, too, when I see somebody drawing.
Like a street artist kind of thing.
Yeah, I like to watch them. And so there was a group of people watching, and this kid, one kid came up, and all of a sudden, he just snatched the pencil away from me that I was using, and he just scribbled all over my drawing, and then he broke the pencil and threw it down and walked off, ran off, whatever. And I that was a bullying incident, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know what to do about it except just tear the page out and start over.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you're an artist, you know, and we'll get into your professional career as that, but when did you pick that skill up?
I think I just, I don't know, probably grade school, mm-hmm. Maybe before that. I mean, I'm sure I did crayon drawings to post on the fridge. But for me, I don't feel this creative urge to create an image of blah, blah, blah. For me, it's more a matter I wanted to see things. Hmm. So at that time, I was interested in cars and airplanes.
Yeah.
So I drew pictures of cars and airplanes.
Sure.
Yeah. And it wasn't until much later that I even thought about, you know, doing nudes or anything like that, which I only did once. And that was just because it was a class assignment.
Right.
I was really quite shocked. You know,
yes,
here I was. I was in college at the time, and I was taking an art class, and all of a sudden, ta-da, walks in this lady, and she drops her robe, and she's there in the buff, and somebody, the art teacher says, okay, we're going to draw Emily today.
And it's like,
so, okay. That was then.
Right.
I think they still do that now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely part of art classes that do that. Now, in high school, did you take any art classes?
Oh, yeah. I majored in art. I majored in art twice. I majored in art when I was in high school for 3 years, I think. I took art all 3 years. I don't know if you call it a major when you're just a sophomore. And then I went, when I started college, I majored in art as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discovered Student Union was a pretty good major as well. And so then I took a break, and that's how I got drafted, was I decided to take a break from school.
Okay.
And then when I went back the second time, I majored in theater because I wanted to work in radio and television.
Right.
And they didn't offer any kind of a journalism degree.
Or communications or any of that kind of stuff.
No, that was before that time. But they did have a theater program.
Right.
And so I went back on the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And majored in theater and worked in theater for a while. Actually, I worked in theater before I majored in theater. And from there, I leapt into radio, and that was the beginning of my commercial career, I guess.
Right. Now, working in theater, does that mean that you use your artistic skills for, like, set design and stuff like that? Or
I did some, but not really.
Okay.
I know what you're saying. You would think, but and that's a visual art,
right?
And so, no, I started off working as a technical director for an outfit called the Oklahoma Theater Company, which was a grant supported in Tulsa, and then I got drafted to be an actor in this production and that production, mm-hmm. and then I went to school, and probably about 90% of what we were doing was about acting and or the technicalities of the set, which would be lighting and sound and mm-hmm. you know things along that line.
Yeah, most of the stuff that people who go to view a show never think about, see, you know, all that kind of stuff, the behind the scenes
everything
activities.
Else
yeah.
The other 90%
yeah,
of the stuff
right.
Yeah.
That's
and,
great.
Yeah, but the actors get all the credits.
Well, yeah. That's the way it should be, you know. We gotta feed those egos.
Yeah, I suppose.
So you stopped going to college, mm-hmm. and the military decided that you were nabbable at that time, so
mm-hmm.
You got sucked into the system. What branch of service did you go?
Army. I don't know that I had any choices.
Okay.
I mean, I was a draftee. My father told me don't volunteer for anything.
Mm.
And so I decided, okay, that's probably not a bad idea. I didn't like the idea of the military. It was completely against my temperament. But I went, and I was offered, if you'll sign up for another 4 years, we'll make you an officer and you can go over and get killed in the first 3 days. If you'll extend for another 4 years, we're going to send you to this school and you can work here and here. If you'll sign up for another 20 years, we'll do this for you. And I turned it all down.
Well, good, smart man.
Yeah.
Because they dangle the carrot, but very rarely do they deliver. You know, so that's
and you would think that I would have wound up, and if I had, and now that as an adult I think about this, and I don't consider myself as having been an adult or very mature at that point. I was just kind of, I was wandering, looking for what I should be doing in life, you know, and when all of that happened, but you know, knowing now that I could have probably steered things, I probably could have started working for special services, and that would have been waiting tables and playing the drums for the band and things like that. But I probably would have enjoyed that more and maybe even wound up stateside, although I could have wound up in Vietnam as well. But but that may have been more suiting, and who knows, I may have extended for another 4 years based on an experience like that or something.
Right, you know, it's like looking back and going, if had I only known.
Known, yeah.
Exactly. So you're now in the Army, and what area of deployment were you in?
They sent me to be a helicopter mechanic, and then all of a sudden they yanked me off the bus, and they sent me to military police school. So, and then from there I got assigned to the 552nd Military Police Group.
Okay.
So I am a genuine, what do you call it, trained, I have the certificate and all that, military police training. A lot of guys just came in from, they were cooked before that.
And sure.
They got thrown in, which is another way really of saying that we need somebody for guard duty 24/7.
Right.
And that's what it turned out to be. But I went and got assigned to the 552nd Military Police, and that was, it was a dormant agency. And then it was the beginning of the surge.
Okay.
And so that's what we were. And our whole unit was assembled in Fort Gordon, Georgia, put together there, put on a troop carrier, shipped across the ocean to the new, we started out at the new Army Central Headquarters in Long Bend.
Okay.
And that was, and it was, it had just been completed. And our task basically was to provide security for the base. And we also did patrols, we ran errands, stuff like that.
Did you have to bust up bar fights and all that kind of stuff?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, patrolling, particularly patrolling the off-limits areas.
Right.
The, there, I guess, you know, anywhere the military goes, there are those areas where there are drugs and violence and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so our job was to go in there and snag the GIs who were in those areas, and write reports and stuff like that. Yeah, I did some of that.
Did your deployment involve any investigations at all? I know sometimes they have an investigational unit within certain collectives like that.
The only thing investigative wise that I did when I was in Vietnam was traffic accidents.
Okay.
Once I was stateside, I was assigned to a military police agency in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, coldest spot in the earth. and I had just come from, a year and a half of well above 90 and lots of times well above 100 degrees as well.
And 90% humidity. And
and Fort Sill, Oklahoma then was 17 degrees, winds out of the north, 20 to 25 miles an hour, and I'm standing in the middle of an intersection directing traffic. It was a very cold experience. So anyway, that was regular police work, and then I was doing investigations then for routine stuff. There was some lady whose refrigerator was haunted, and we would have to go there and investigate her refrigerator for ghosts, and, which was, I mean, you know, she was a widow, and every time she called, why, some nice, handsome GI military policeman would show up to talk to her. So we did that, locker thefts, We wrote, of course, we did traffic investigations. Every now and then I do an investigation following a bar fight or something like that, you know, who stabbed who, that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's interesting for our audience to get a behind-the-scenes glimpse, much like in the theater. What you don't see most of the time is what happens with the military police and why it's an important division within the military itself. You know, we're so used to seeing, you know, shows like NCIS and movies like Jack Reacher, you know, where they go out and bust heads and, you know, they're doing all these deep, covert investigations and stuff like that. And most of it's pretty mundane.
Yeah, it's Hollywood.
Yeah, I know. You got to, you know, zizz it up, you know.
Yeah.
So now, how long were you in the military?
2 years. I was a 2-year draftee. And I was offered all of these opportunities to extend, but declined every one of them. And the one thing that I remember when at the end of, I was a short timer, I had like 2 weeks left to go. And some people will identify with this the other way. But I remember this, I was talking with this one captain, and he said, "Oh, you're short." He says, "Are you going to re-up?" I said, "No." He says, "Well, you ought to." And I said, "Oh, why? Why? What's in the Army for me?" And he said, "Well, you get to shoot a rocket."
Okay.
I thought, yeah, okay, 4th of July, I'll shoot a rocket. I just, you know, there are people who like to shoot rockets and there are people who don't. And I guess I was one of the people who wasn't necessarily interested in shooting a rocket, although I've seen them go. They're quite impressive.
Right, the power behind them, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we're going to close out kind of your military time. What's your best takeaway from that experience?
Best takeaway? Well, for starters, I think it was a different reality. And what I realized was that while we're sitting here comfortably in our chairs, enjoying life and the weather's nice and everything's nice and hunky-dory, there's the other reality, which is, no, everything isn't hunky-dory, and there's a conflict of some sort. And if you're involved with the military, that suddenly becomes your reality. Yep. But more importantly, what I realized was that any given day, could be today, could be in the next 30 minutes, any given day, something could happen.
Yeah.
We could have an emergency of some sort. Sure. It could be a big one. It could be a big, nasty fire. It could be suddenly a missile from North Korea comes flying up. You know, things could change.
A dust up in the Middle East that affects geopolitics. Who knows, you know?
Yeah.
Any of that kind
Any
of stuff.
Given day, something could happen to change things drastically. And then the reality changes. And for me, that's a talking point, if you will, that most people don't understand, unless you've gone through the war experience, unless you've actually seen something really horrific like that, then you have no real understanding of what it means to live in that other reality. And the other thing, I think, is that, and this is, I didn't take it away at the time, but I do now. Because I've learned a little bit about the history of Vietnam and how that started and so on and so on. And also I'm talking with a number of other vets. Because, you know, that's another perspective. Not all Vietnam vets have the same perspective.
It's almost it's as different as the individuals that were there.
That and the assignments,
right.
I think, makes a big part of it. Now, I got shot at, but I never engaged in any kind of a battle or anything. I never killed anybody. But I met plenty of my friends that came back later, and we were all, you know, in Tulsa sitting around drinking beer and saying, "Hey, I haven't seen you in a while. How's it been? Blah, blah, blah."
Right.
You get his Vietnam experience where he killed maybe 100 and some odd people, so many they were not even countable.
Right.
And he has a different perspective on what the experience was all about. And some people take away experiences and incorporate them into their lives, and some people handle it a little better, and they're able to kind of slough it off and move on anyway. So it's a life-changing experience, I think. And I think there's an old saying that says, I wouldn't give a plug nickel to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience, nonetheless, was, when you're talking about life experience, it's kind of a valuable experience to have.
Well, and during that, you grew up a lot.
Oh, I don't know that I did that.
One last thing. You know, you'd mentioned the awareness factor of how things can change, you know, mm-hmm. in short periods of time. Is that something that's always kind of running in the background for you?
That's part of the PTSD.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm what they call hypervigilant, mm-hmm. Which means that I am incredibly aware of my surroundings, and it's the times when I decide to just kind of relax for a little bit, sit quietly, and suddenly a noise, loud noise of some sort mm-hmm. occurs, and man, I'm out of my skin. But the PTSD experience, that... that does. It colors your whole life. And that's another thing, too, is that, you know, you for all of the people who went to Vietnam, some of them came back with incredible PTSD.
Yes.
I was in a group session, and there was a guy who had just come back from, I think, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the group I was with, there was maybe one other guy who was a Vietnam-era vet there. And the rest of them were either Iraqi or Afghanistan or some other kind of Middle Eastern conflict.
Yeah.
And he had his head buried in his knees, mm-hmm. essentially. I mean, he couldn't talk. He shook.
Mm.
And I just felt so sorry for him, because I knew that he had seen experiences that literally took away his ability to control his own life.
Right.
And then there were others who, you know, there was one guy I knew, he thought it was all great fun.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't
it? He'd go back and do it again.
Yeah.
Because he thought it was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different strokes for different folks.
He got to shoot a rocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
So now you're out of the military. You mm-hmm. got your discharge. How long was it between then and when you re-enrolled in college?
Took a while.
Still on that path of finding yourself?
Well, I was in the military police.
Right.
And for some reason, I came out of the Army gung-ho. I came out thinking that, well, that's what I'm going to do in life. I'm going to be a policeman. So I went down to the Tulsa police station. And at that time, they had a height requirement of 5'9" minimum, mm-hmm. and I was only 5'8".
Right.
So I couldn't get on with the police force, and I don't know if it was because I wrote down on all my job applications that I was a Vietnam vet or not, but a lot of the jobs that I applied for, it seemed like they weren't interested.
That was happening a lot back
then.
Yeah.
So at that time, I wound up working for Burns International Detective Agency.
Okay.
Started off as a security guard, and then they found out I knew a little bit about electronics, so they sent me out to repair alarms.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked some other jobs. I worked for some guy who was an alarm manufacturer, and I was the manufacturer. He stuck me in a back room, and I built alarm panels 8 hours a day for his company. But I worked for Burns, and then I wound up working as a private detective. So I was filling all those roles. But the reason I say that I made a fairly good private detective was because at that time I was 23, I think, and I looked like I was 16.
Oh.
And so it was really easier for me to pose as a student, just kind of hang around.
Yeah.
Well, nobody pays any attention to a student, so you'd be surprised what you can overhear.
Right.
Did a lot of background type investigations, and then I decided to go back to school. I realized, well, yeah, I don't really like this. I'm really basically an artist at heart. And then I went back to school, majored in theater, and then from there jumped into radio.
Radio?
Yeah.
So were you like a DJ on the radio?
I was a disc jockey. I worked for small stations up in upstate New York. Bigger than this station, but small.
All right.
The first station was 100-watt AM station, and that's the one that I had been working radio roughly about a week. Maybe it was a month, but it seems like it was just only a week. And I have to tell the story about this was a great learning experience for me when I first started in radio. Some friends of mine bought the station from this outfit out of Tennessee, and they played country music. And so the new owners thought, well, we'll get rid of this nasty old country music, and we'll play some rock and roll. We'll show these people what rock and roll is like. And yeah, because I mean, the ratings went down in a hurry. So eventually the country western found its way back. But I remember my first day, and so I'm standing there, and there's the microphone, and there's the board, and there are the turntables and all that sort of stuff. And the guy's showing me what the various switches do, and he says, well, now, why don't you give that a try? And I said, okay. And so I thought to myself, and this guy's from Tennessee. I mean, he talked like a hick, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
And so I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to show this guy what you're supposed to sound like when you talk on the radio. So I threw open the mic and I said, this is WGMF. No, I didn't say that. No, I didn't say that. That's my training has gotten on the way there. I said, this is WGMF. And then I closed the mic, and after I introduced the record or whatever, and he says, okay, well, now, first of all, it's not W, it's W. And I felt about this big, and I'm indicating about a half inch here, because I felt like I just embarrassed myself, and he showed me up just like that. And that was my first moment in radio. And then it was like the next week, the flood of 72 came through, flooded upstate New York and parts of Pennsylvania. And I've forgotten all of the figures. I looked them up recently, but there were a few hundred people who died as a result of that. I think it was 24 deaths in upstate New York alone. But we were a relief station. We were the Red Cross actually moved in and started giving tetanus shots in our studio. We had blankets, we had canned goods, people were bringing all sorts of things that would be needed in an emergency like that. And we spent all of our radio time basically communicating for the area.
Right.
We read lists of names. Hello for the family of the Smith family. Your mother is alive and well, and she's at a Red Cross center, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Just trying to reunite people who were concerned about people. All the phone lines were down.
Right.
And we were really the only communication for the entire area. If you wanted to know where to go find medical help, we were the ones who were announcing where that was. If somebody was lost, we would air, we are looking for the following people, and we would list all those were. It was incredible, and people would come into the studio, and they'd bring gifts of all kinds.
Right.
To say thank you for what we had done for them.
Right. Yep.
And so we had, and it was later on, somebody said, this was interesting, I wasn't there at the time, but somebody said some guy showed up with a pickup truck full of apples as soon as they ripened on the trees and delivered them to the station. I was gone by then.
Right.
So I worked for these small radio stations, and then my wife at that time decided she didn't really care much for upstate New York, and I think she was basically homesick, so we moved back to Tulsa, and so then I worked for a larger station in Tulsa, Oklahoma for a couple of years. And so that was my radio career, and then from there I jumped off into advertising.
Right. And you've actually utilized some of those long-ago gotten skills to help various entities here in town. So that's kind of cool, you know, that you're still keeping your fingers in it.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. So you mentioned a wife, so I always have to ask, you know, how did that happen? Where did you guys meet up, and why did she say, yeah, I'm going to hang out with this guy?
Well, which one?
Well, we'll talk about the first one.
Okay. The first one, we met just before I went off to Vietnam.
Okay.
Literally the day before.
Oh, wow.
And then, I don't know, she just seemed infatuated with me for whatever reason, but I was leaving, so I didn't didn't occur to me to strike up any kind of a relationship. And then when I came back from Vietnam, almost the day after I came back, a friend of mine said, "Oh, well, hey, let's have a party." And he set me up with a blind date, which was the same woman that, I had met just the day before I shipped out.
Right. Now, did he know that?
He did not know that.
Oh, okay. So he wasn't a matchmaker.
But I knew that, and this lady knew that.
Uh-huh.
And she was convinced that it must be an omen from...
Kismet, as they call it.
Yeah, whatever. And so that's why we got married, I think. And that's a poor reason to get married, to tell you the honest truth. So that one didn't last very long. Mm-hmm. That one lasted essentially until we got back from New York, and then she decided she wanted to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So that left me single again.
Yeah. Oh, well.
So I've been married, let's see, 20, 30, 30 yeah, oh, yeah, not quite 40 times since.
Oh, really? That's good.
And, and I lie a lot, too. let's see. I think I'm on my fourth.
On your fourth, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it. I think okay. I'm up to number four. And I don't even know how. Let's see. Wife number two I met at a radio station. Wife number three I met during a political campaign. And wife number four, she lived in the same building I did.
Huh, okay. So. Convenience.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, and that's kind of an amazing phenomenon, too, when I think about it, that the person that you wind up with is probably from within your immediate circle.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes relationships fire up that are, from coast to coast. Sometimes
right.
relationships, but usually it's your
sure.
your immediate circle,
yep.
which I find kind of interesting.
I don't think it's changed all that much, even with the advent of modern technology and the internet and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, probably
it's still
hasn't.
Fairly geographical in
mm-hmm.
nature, so
mm-hmm.
and it keeps it really close.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of all the jobs you've had, which has been the most interesting?
Probably the advertising job.
Okay.
Because it involved a lot of things. I went out and hiked through the fields to find long-lost billboards.
Mm-hmm.
I dealt with a variety of different medium, newspaper, radio, television, magazines, brochures, mailers of various types, and newsletters,
mm-hmm.
All of these various things. So there's a lot of variety in that.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my clients were smaller businesses.
Okay.
My major clients were larger businesses, but many of the others were smaller. Like I did a hobby shop, for example.
Uh-huh.
And he had model airplanes and model trains, and the TV spot that I am most proud of is the one, and that was the most fun, was the one that I did for his model trains.
Okay.
Because we could put the camera right down on the train set.
Yeah.
And it was like, full scale.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I got to do a lot of things like that. Private detectiving, I found it to be kind of boring.
Hmm.
And I guess it's because in a lot of cases I didn't really know the whole case.
Right.
I just got a piece of paper and it said follow this guy for a week.
Right.
And I wrote reports about where he went and that sort of thing, but I never had any idea what it related to.
Interesting.
It wasn't Columbo.
Right.
It wasn't like I was how does this figure into the case? And so, but yeah, I think the advertising just because it was a wide range of things. Radio was fun. When it was the smaller stations, when it got to be the bigger station, it was not fun because it was so formatted.
Right.
You played the music that they wanted you to play at the particular time they wanted you to play it. And then really about the only thing you were allowed to say was time. We used to call it time and temperature. It's 11:47 and 52 degrees outside, and here's our next tune, pow, and so you push the button, and after a while, it seemed like all the music just kind of went thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump, thumpity-thump. And,
right.
And that's the problem when you work in the field. My father used to say that's why we have hobbies. so that you can enjoy some little something that you do on your desk or whatever. Right. But it's not your job, because when it becomes your job, then it ceases to be as enjoyable.
That's very true.
So this radio station has been more fun.
Yeah.
Than the big radio.
It's definitely not corporate radio, and that's been, I think, one of the biggest downfalls on the airwaves is the corporations taking over and dictating.
But by and large, that formula stuff, it's what people listen to, and it's what I call the vanilla syndrome, in that at an ice cream social, what flavor of ice cream do you serve? Vanilla.
Yeah.
Because more people like vanilla than any other flavor. Right. And then you followed up chocolate and strawberry, and you're pretty well covered. And then if you really want to get fancy, you throw in something like chocolate mocha, whatever, butter pecan. But if you just throw out the butter pecan, most people are going to say, why did they choose this flavor?
Right.
And so you serve vanilla. And that's the problem with corporate radio, is that it is vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's what everybody likes.
Yeah, it meets the demographic. So absolutely. Yeah. So speaking of radio stations... Want to put out a little plug here. It's you're listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in Brookings, Oregon. And we're talking with Dan Sherman today on the program Our Veteran Community. So we've been moving Dan through his life, so to speak. And, you know, he's into the advertising game now. And
I'm retired.
Yeah, well, I know you're retired now. So advertising was happening in what city?
My biggest advertising would be in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, some of my clients were, I had, this was interesting, I worked for an outfit called Adventures Incorporated. And he owned, this is one guy, and he owned four carpet companies.
Hmm.
Three of them were just one store piece. And then he owned one company that in its heyday was 14 stores, covered both Oklahoma City and other surrounding towns.
Mm-hmm.
And then he changed wives, and it all went downhill in a hurry or something like that. But that was a large client. I worked for a satellite company. The people who were the uplink guys for Ted Turner's WTBS.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They then developed a number of different programs. For example, the biggest moneymaker and et cetera was Satellite Program Network, which probably nobody's ever heard of.
Mm-mm.
But they had higher ratings than the things you have heard of, like CNN and HBO and so on and so on.
Right. Interesting.
And at the time, they were doing, I guess vanity publishing is the best way to put it. They actually had people who produced shows like The Cooking Channel. Okay. And all these shows, incidentally, went on to be things like the Discovery Channel, the Travel Channel, or whatever.
Right.
As it shook out in later years when these programs were being sold back and forth between various networks. But it was a big network, and they were actually one of my first major breadwinning clients. And so I did the advertising for the Satellite Program Network. They developed one of the first news formats for cable. I think it was called Keyfax. They were the first one to put to offer stereophonic music to cable companies nationwide.
Interesting.
Wow. It started off, John DeRemus, who was a disc jockey out of New York, he had a program that he put on airplanes called Music in the Air.
Okay.
You know those little headphones that you would stick in your ears that they would give you that sounded horrible?
Yeah.
Which, incidentally, I'm going to regress for just a moment to Vietnam. Those little headphones. I remember getting on the plane. My time was up. I was shipping out. I was getting on a plane to go to, I think, Okinawa, Japan, Honolulu, and then San Francisco to come home. And it was, it wasn't a Huey helicopter. It was a Boeing 707.
Oh, right.
Four big engines up there. And the flight attendant came along and was passing out little headphones. And so I stuck them in my ears, and I played around with the different little buttons and stuff.
Right.
And tuned up what I guess I would best describe as elevator music.
And Muzak.
Muzak. But at that particular point in time, when I was, when the plane took off and we got up to a few thousand feet, and I said, well, we're out of rocket range.
Interesting.
And I felt like at that time that all of Vietnam was behind me.
You could decompress.
I was decompressing, and I was listening to this beautiful elevator music in my ears at the time, and that was a magical experience.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
And so I've always had a soft spot on my heart for some of the better elevator music. Anyway, what was I talking about
before
that?
Well, you were talking about the development of stereo.
Stereo. So it was music in the air. John Doremus, he had this, and so they just essentially took all his tapes and offered him, shot him up to the satellite and offered him to all the cable companies. Mm-hmm. And that didn't fly very well, so then they changed it to satellite cable audio networks, I think. That's a real mouthful.
Yeah.
And that didn't fly very well, so then they changed it to Starship Stereo, and that flew.
Starship Stereo.
Oh, cool. And that one flew. And so that was the very first music service that you could get on your cable, something other than just television.
Right.
And so they started that. So I worked for them, and then they started, the economy crashed, and the owners essentially started selling the company.
This was back in the 70s?
Yeah, or early 80s. So I'd have to go back and look.
Yeah, because it hit out here on the West Coast pretty tough, too. Lots of RV businesses went under and all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Late 70s, I think it was, something like that.
Yeah.
All right. So the economy crashed.
Well, and so then I was unemployed for a while, actually. And then at that point, I wound up picking up the carpet client. And also my other client was the Oklahoma Burglar and Fire Alarm Association. And this is an interesting thing that when I started advertising, because I knew a lot of guys who worked for the cop shop, and I was working in and out of police work, as time went on. But when I was working for the Oklahoma Burglar and Fire Alarm Association, which is another mouthful, the OKBFAA, we used to just call it OKBF for short, we were pushing fire alarms for a residential for residential use.
Right.
And that was kind of heartwarming because I realized it was an effort that I was involved in that was saving lives.
Mm-hmm. Making a difference.
Yeah, even though we realized that came December, morning of December 25th, those smoke detectors lost their 9-volt batteries to some little truck or something, you know. And maybe it didn't get replaced, but and that was tragic whenever, you know, the firemen would go in and say, well, they had a smoke alarm, but as you can see here, the battery thingy's hanging down, and they obviously had never, they didn't have a working battery in it. So those, and then, like I said, I had stereo stores, the hobby shop, that one was the most fun, computer store, I did some medical illustrations for a while, and I'm trying to remember what I had a long list of all of my clients once upon a time.
But yeah, well, that's okay.
Somewhere I mean, buried in a file.
It speaks to the variety of things that you've done and who you've interacted with over your life, and that's what makes the individual story so interesting. We all have interesting stories, and I'll have people say, oh, I'm boring. I'm going, man, spend an hour with me. We're going to drag some of this stuff out because there is no such thing as a boring person. Now, I haven't met one yet, at least, so that's good. So you're still in Oklahoma, right? Or
yeah,
had you moved to the West Coast yet?
No. I moved to the West Coast when I retired. Yeah, Oklahoma was, I spent about 50 years there. I mean, did a little stint in upstate New York where I worked for the small radio stations, the Army, and they gave me a chance to travel abroad to see another country, Vietnam. I traveled around the United States a little bit living here and there. But for most part, Tulsa, Oklahoma, yeah.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, All of the years that I was there, I've never seen a tornado.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I've had people say, yeah, there's one right outside. And I go look, and I didn't see one. I saw a lot of clouds, a lot of rain, a lot of whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, you're fortunate in that.
I've seen the damage.
Yes. And those things would be scary as all get out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so you retired. Now what are you doing with yourself? Why did you decide that you're going to move from Tulsa, where you've been forever?
Forever to here. I was working in Tulsa and getting near retirement. I'm working, at this time, I'm working for a juvenile prison. I was a state, an Oklahoma State police officer assigned to the prison. I was the key control officer there. And that was when the economy took another downturn. And since advertising is one of the first things that people quit doing when the economy downturns, right. You know, I went around to all the ad agencies and said, well, say, and they said, no, we're hurting too. So I found a little bit of work here and there, but finally I just said, I need to just go find any kind of a real job. And a friend of mine turned me on to this particular position. So I did that for 8 years, actually. I was a, you know, full-blown cop counting keys. That in itself was an interesting thing. I had 5,000 some odd keys to keep track of.
Jeez.
on a campus. And so I retired from, that's what I actually retired from. And so I was filling out retirement papers with this friend of mine who also worked there. And I said, where do you think would be a good place to retire? And he said, well, I'll tell you a little secret. Well, he was from Eugene, and the only reason he was back in Oklahoma is because he was settling up the affairs for his parents who had died.
Gotcha.
And so he was working there. He was a psychologist, and so he was telling me about both Bandon and Brookings, and he said, the weather's great. He said, now, there are some problems. He says, it's remote. It's in the boonies, so to speak. If you want big city, you're going to have to drive a ways to do that. But so I went home, went online, and pulled up, put in a search, Brookings, Oregon, and fell in love with the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd seen a little bit of the coast when I was in the Army going to Vietnam, because we flew from Fort Benning, Georgia to San Francisco. And got on a troop carrier in San Francisco.
Okay.
And so that gave me a bit of an insight as to the kind of climate and the ocean. I think those two factors there. And having lived in Oklahoma, where it's northeastern Oklahoma is actually fairly green.
Mm-hmm.
They call it green country. And the western part of Oklahoma tends to be more arid and more desert-like. There are patches of desert in Oklahoma. But the overall experience, weather climate experience, is hot and dry or cold.
Right.
That's basically it.
Right.
Might snow every now and then. And I just wanted something more. And at that point in time, I was divorced. I was looking for something else to do in my life other than just live in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Right, new chapter, new beginning.
So I flew out here, I visited, went up and down the coast, drove up to Eugene just to see what that was all about. I didn't know about Medford at the time. I didn't think much of Grants Pass at that time, but now I think it's a pretty neat little town. And so I visited, I decided this is pretty cool, so I went back to Tulsa and started packing my bags, and then I met Teresa, and I said, well, I'm going to Brookings. So she and I both flew out here, and she looked it over, and she's a big city gal. She grew up she grew up as a child in a little itty-bitty town.
Right.
But then she moved to the big city, got employment in the big city, and so she just decided she's lived in Boston and Phoenix and, you know, a number of other places.
High density kind of situations.
Yeah. So her initial reaction was she wasn't going to like Brookings at all because it was a little small town, et cetera, et cetera. But she came here, we sat on the beach, we ate in the restaurants, went to a concert in the park. We went to one of the plays at the who are the guys down here on this end of town, not the Pelican players, but the other ones. We went to one of their plays, and she said, oh, this is a nice little artsy community. Yeah, okay. So here we are, and we've been here about 4 years now.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. All right, so we've got you into Brookings. We know how you got here, why you got here. Mm-hmm. So since you've been here, what have your experiences been?
Positive for the most part. Mm-hmm. My experience has been, well, working with the radio station, I did that. I was on the board for a while. It a bit too much activity for me, so I wound up resigning. Let's see. Of course, there's still my drawing board. And like you say, I do play music. I play it for myself. Mm-hmm. Like you say, you get a lot less criticism when you do that. And plus, it's a sense of freedom.
Right.
If you go to a gig and you're playing covers, and I've played drums for various bands through the years, in addition to being with a drum group, which I can explain in a minute. If you're at home and you're just playing what you want to play, that's complete artistic freedom.
Sure.
I can say, screw the chord structure.
Yeah, just take off and do whatever.
I'm going to try this one.
Right.
And, it gives you a lot of artistic freedom. Things that you can create things knowing that somebody else may not like it, but it doesn't matter because you're just playing for yourself and your own creativity and so on. So I tend to do that. And then I'm also involved with a, it's not really a drum circle, it's a drum group, but it's probably going to be a drum circle. Mm-hmm. And so I'll go ahead and plug it on January the 14th at what will be advertised as 7 o'clock in the evening at the Hollencutt Hall.
Right.
Right across from the Lucky Seven Casino. Mm-hmm. We are going to have an open drum circle, hopefully that will involve the people from Crescent City who were also drummers that don't necessarily come all the way up to Brookings to drum. Hopefully people from other smaller areas like Gasky. There was some lady who came to one of the drum things. Yeah from those areas.
Right.
And hopefully we'll be able to pull from more areas. They had the Del Norte drum group met there a month two ago, and it was a pretty good-sized group. It was probably 20, 30 people.
Yeah, you have to keep me in the loop on that, and, of course, obviously get it in the Insider magazine and on the air and all that kind of stuff, too.
Yes.
Drum circles are very powerful. I've participated in some, and they're pretty amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of, getting down to wrapping things up as far as...
Oh, wait a minute. I'm only on to page 3.
Well, that's okay. We can have you back, in another month or two. are you currently enrolled in the VA healthcare system?
Yes.
Okay. Have you had opportunity to use our local clinic at all?
Yes.
Okay. What's your overall feeling about the clinic? Realizing that it is limited, it's just a clinic, it's not a hospital, diagnostic center, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Okay.
I think it's definitely an upgrade from when it was over on Fifth Street.
Right.
Okay. It's a big upgrade. My only fault with it is that because we are in a remote area, that means that being able to attract qualified medical personnel is a bit difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had enough little trying to straighten things out with the clinic, which I'm not faulting them for the simple reason that I realized what they are.
Right.
Like you say, it's they're not a big... And the VA system itself, I'm basically pleased with, but I realize they have all these problems.
Yes.
Which is primarily that they're scrounging to get money to be able to get the things that they need, and the money's just not there. And that's another soapbox that one can get into about, are we taking care of our veterans? And I would say, well, yeah, somewhat. Yeah, we are.
Better than it had been, but lots of room for improvement.
Better than it had been, but lots of room for improvement.
Right, I guess.
And again, it's lack of money. I mean, the money goes for other things.
Or to bigger areas, you know, larger cities with the VA hospitals and things like that. So it's tough.
Right, right. And so I would say that my experience with the VA system in Tulsa has been quite good.
Mm-hmm.
As good as with the non-veteran medical services, the regular hospitals, et cetera. And here I'm as pleased with this VA clinic as I am with the Fifth Street Clinic, the Curry Medical.
Which just opened their emergency room.
Right.
Yay. So that's a
yay and a nay, and you know, as far as I'm concerned, my problem with it is, and they have since worked on this. They have basically said, if you come in, you'll get same day service. If you come in, you'll get a same day appointment. So if you need urgent care, you call. You say, "Hi, I just sliced my finger open, and I need to get a Band-Aid or whatever for it." They'll get you in.
Yeah, it's bumps and bruises and scrapes and sprains.
And I suspect what will probably happen is that there will be a need for out-and-out urgent care, and I think that by the Curry outfit not being in the urgent care business, so to speak, somebody else is going to take it up.
It's possible. We'll see what shakes out in the future on this, but things are on the upswing, and I'm looking forward to the potential for everybody getting, you know, good medical, timely medical attention. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think the main thing is that by a number of people getting up and voicing their concerns, the Curry Medical System has made the necessary adjustments to accommodate those concerns.
Right.
And I think the same is probably true with the VA clinic over here, too.
Yeah, the town hall meetings that they've held.
The town hall meetings, people
come,
express their concerns.
Yeah.
And
we've had great forums for people to become involved in the process. Mm-hmm. And if you're not involved in the process, well, guess what? You know, you get what you get.
Yeah.
So, okay, Dan, I want to thank you very much. We've been talking to Dan Sherman today, a relatively new resident to the area, but one who brings a lot of life experience, and he's given back to the community. So best wishes going into the new year.
Thank you.
Say hi to Teresa for me.
Yes.
And, you know, tell your other veteran friends that, hey, I don't bite. I'll be more than happy to interview them on the radio. So
somebody explain to me why there are tooth marks. At
any rate, you've been listening to KCIWLP Community Radio out of Brookings, Oregon. Have a wonderful rest of your day or evening. Thanks.
The opinions expressed here were those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in the program.